context and the mind frame of the believer.
Well, they're saying it can't be meaningful for anybody if it doesn't rule out something. If there isn't some condition that you can specify that would falsify the belief, then it isn't asserting anything at all. If your assertion is congenial with every state of affairs in the world, every conceivable state of affairs, then necessarily you're not asserting anything whatsoever. If it doesn't rule out something, then it doesn't rule in anything. Okay, R.M. Hare takes another approach. Okay, he doesn't talk about there being a challenge involved in the experience of suffering, but the challenge is never overwhelming. He says rather that religious assertions, that religious claims, are a very special kind of statement. As a matter of fact, they don't assert anything. And so he wants to give Flew that part of the challenge. He wants to say, that's right, religious claims don't assert anything. Nevertheless, they are a very special kind of statement, which is meaningful nonetheless. What does he call this kind of statement?
Blick.
A blick. Right. Anybody want to translate that for us? What's a blick? He didn't make it up. It's a German word. What's a blick? Nobody?
Belief, experience, all kind of tied up together somehow.
A mindset. It's kind of like Gestalt psychology, isn't it? It's an organizing picture or a vision. It's a seeing of a certain sort. It's an organizing seeing of things. It's a blip. Now, he says, while assertions about blips, or assertions which constitute a blip, do not assert anything, they are nevertheless meaningful. Why are they meaningful? Because they make a great deal of difference to the way you approach the world. And he gives the counter illustration of a don who is studying, I believe, at Oxford. And this don has a particular kind of blick. What does he call it? Am I properly perceiving that we haven't done the reading today? This is very enjoyable and easy reading. If you haven't done it today, by all means, pick it up and do it. This will be the easiest reading of the term. It's just a bunch of stories. If you can understand the point of a story, you can do philosophy now. All the other stuff required modal logic and all that. This is philosophy for all of us.
An insane blick,
right. What is the insane blick? He has the blick, he has the worldview, he has this perception that everybody's out to kill him. He's an extreme paranoid. All right, now what happens? His fellow dons try to give him evidence of how his friends care for him. They give him parties. They go out of their way to help him. And all the while, as they're giving this evidence, he's looking at the evidence as just a way to dupe him all the further. To draw him in, you see, to suck him into this web of deception so that when he's not looking, they'll be able to kill him. And so every bit of evidence turns out to be a two-edged sword because of his blick. Now, does it make any difference at all that he has this blick? You say, every piece of evidence you give him is congenial with his blick. I mean, all the counter evidence turns out not to be counter evidence for him. Nothing will falsify his belief that people are out to kill him. Nothing. Now, on Flew's basis, he's not asserting anything at all, because what he's saying is congenial with everything. He's not asserting anything because he's not ruling anything out. No possible state of affairs is going to take that belief away. Now, what Hare is saying is, you're right, Flew, he's not asserting anything, but he certainly has a meaningful statement nonetheless. It's meaningful because there's all the difference in the world between an insane and a sane blick. And the religious person has a particular blick on the world. Now, we want to ask ourselves more particularly, what is a blick? And unfortunately, this is where Hare lets us down. At this point, he offers us only stories and analogies, and so you get no real sophisticated philosophical analysis of what a blick is. You only get a feeling for it on the basis of the analogies he offers. Now, I want to go on to John Hick's response to the challenge of flu in just a moment. But before I do that, I think it's important to make one aside as an evangelical to what Hare is doing. Please, no, I'm going to come back and I'm going to answer this in a way that's different from Mitchell, Hare, and Hick. But right now, I have to at least point out that this approach by way of blicks is really, I think, a selling out of the faith. It's a selling out because it amounts to radical conformism to science, a conformism to counter-evidence. Conformism is one of the basic strategies that has been adopted through the history of the Christian Church with respect to apologetical defense. Conformism characterizes that school of thought that says Christianity is congenial with whatever the scientist or the experts say, because Christianity is not saying anything definite about the world. Science and religion can never conflict because science and religion are talking about different things. And that's called a radical conformism, because what it means, what that amounts to, is conforming to the scientific worldview of your day, or the scientific assertions of the day, or the experts of the whatever opinion may be reigning in that, at that particular time. Science, according to the conformist approach to apologetics, is and always will be all right just the way it is. And for that reason, we are precluded from doing any Christian critique of science internally. To Flew's conclusion that religious commitment does not involve holding certain propositions to be true, and that to express one's commitment is not to make any assertion, what Hare is actually pleading is nolo contende, right? We will not answer. There is nothing to be said. We're neither guilty nor innocent, because we're not in that ballpark at all. We're not interested in making assertions. By regarding Flew's argument for the meaninglessness of religious assertions as decisive, Hare, I think, has in fact surrendered the entire field of facts and the assertion of facts to the scientist. Religious commitment for Hare consists of simply having a distinctive blick on the world. Now, if Hare's theory of the blick approach to religious commitment is meant to be a theory about Christianity, then I think he's surely mistaken. Because as a matter of fact, people sometimes do surrender their Christian commitments. People do sometimes, in the face of counter-evidence from the scientists, surrender what was their previous profession of faith. What they have come to believe from the source, the Bible, they give up in the face of what they think is overwhelming evidence. And so, if nothing else, Hare is certainly wrong descriptively about what Christian commitment is, because that isn't the way Christian commitment historically has functioned. As a matter of fact, most Christians will look into what kind of revision is necessary in their thinking when a conflict emerges between the claims of the experts and the claims of the Bible. However, I don't think Hare is telling us how Christian commitment has in fact functioned. He's not trying to give us a description of Christian commitment. I think he's really giving us a prescription I think he's saying this is how religious people ought to react to counter evidence. He's recommending very tacitly that Christians revise their commitments in such a way that no conflict can ever emerge between them and the scientific establishment. And in that sense, he represents a radical conformism, which is an evangelical I have to object to, because science and religion can conflict, because religious people are making statements that have a bearing on our scientific worldview. Okay, let's go on and look at Hicks' response, unless you want to stop there.
As I read the article, it seemed that the Blick might be on the level of worldview, at least at the first week of class, on that level, he does have something to say.
That's right. You could reinterpret care in terms of a worldview that a man will not relinquish. The difficulty is that he explicates, by way of analogy and story, what this Blick is in such a way that facts have nothing to do with it whatsoever. And as you know, the Christian worldview is not immune from factual considerations. As Machen said many years ago, it's a historical religion and it's based on history. And consequently, we can't say it's simply a floating kind of attitude toward which, toward the facts. And that's why I don't give him that favorable interpretation. I think, in fact, he represents a radical conformism toward counter-evidence. Okay, let's look now at John Hick's response. And somebody tell me how Hick responds to Flew's challenge that we aren't asserting anything at all and therefore our religious claims are meaningless. Yeah.
Doesn't Hick, understand, try to say that claims and assertions are meaningful in and of themselves?
No.
He doesn't?
No. He does not affirm that at all, in fact. If you got that from the reading, then I think it would be good to go back and look at it again. He would not agree with what you said. They are not meaningful in and of themselves. Hick again accepts the challenge. He says, you're right, Flew. If religious claims are to have any meaning, then they must rule something out. They must rule something in. And so what is the concrete meaning lying behind religious assertions?
There's life after death.
Go ahead.
Most viable, they can be verified. You discuss the truth.
No, falsifiability can't be verified. Verification and falsification are opposite ends of the spectrum. Falsification means you can specify conditions under which the falsity of the assertion would be recognized. Verification is you can specify conditions under which the truth of the assertion has been found out.
And he discusses the verification possibilities of life after death.
Exactly. It's what's called the eschatological verification. Hick says, the believer's claims stand or fall on a certain future expectation. The believer expects a certain future experience to take place. And his eschatological claims about man surviving death and encountering God therefore make his religious assertions meaningful. Because those claims rule out annihilation, and they rule out atheism. And since they specifically rule out the experiences associated with atheistic or annihilistic views, therefore Christianity is meaningful because of this possibility of eschatological verification. What immediately strikes you as somehow unsatisfactory with this answer? Well, you see, it's just the slight problem that it's verifiable, but it's not falsifiable.
Is that right? You can verify an eschatological claim, but you cannot falsify an eschatological claim. Why can't you falsify an eschatological claim?
So it's further down the road somewhere, perhaps.
Well, not just because it's down the road. I mean, the day will come where decisively a person could know that it's true or false. But if it's false, then there's no consciousness to know that it's false. You see, if it's true, if there is the beatific vision waiting for us, to use the Thomistic categories, then it'll all be verified in the end, and those who go to hell will be verified for them too. But if it's false, if after all we should have eaten and drinking and been merry because tomorrow we die and that's the end, click, darkness, it's all over, then there's nobody there to know that it was wrong. You see, if you could know that it's wrong after you die, then it would have verified it, because that would show that there's consciousness after death. You can always verify it if you're conscious. But if it's wrong, then you can't verify or falsify it. And so there's this kind of one-sidedness to the venture. Now, Hick does say that he thinks that he's still making an assertion, even if that assertion makes no difference in this life. And he likens that to two men who are traveling on a road. And he says they can argue about the condition of the road as much as they want and agree about it or disagree about it and still differ as to the destination of the road. And so he says in this life it may not make any difference at all. The road of life up to the point of our destination, the believer and the unbeliever can agree about what they see, what the state of the war in Vietnam is, or what the state of poverty may be. All these things were taking place at the time he was writing. He said, look, the believer and the unbeliever, they don't have to differ about anything there, but they certainly differ as to where the road is leading. Of the war in Vietnam is, or what the state of poverty may be, all these things that were taking place at the time he was writing. He said, look, the believer and the unbeliever, they don't have to differ about anything there, but they certainly differ as to where the road is leading. Okay, so he says, I'm making an assertion, even if it doesn't make any difference in this life. But as I pointed out, what he's really saying is that he has a verifiable assertion if it is true, but he doesn't have a falsifiable assertion by anyone under any conditions. I think something further can be said about Hick's approach. I think we can legitimately ask, is Hick giving us a religious point of view that requires a transcendent God? To rephrase the question more meaningfully now, do all conceptions of an afterlife require a transcendent God? Could not the unbeliever say to Hick, well, maybe we will survive our death, maybe there will be consciousness after death? It isn't to say there's going to be a beatific vision of God. Doesn't mean we're going to encounter our Maker. Maybe we just live in a world of spirits. Maybe when all is said and done, the animists are right. Maybe there is an afterlife, but one that doesn't require a God. And so if that's the case, even what Hick says is verifiable, that is, an afterlife, doesn't show the meaningfulness of religious assertions, or at least Christian religious assertions. And in that case, do religious claims really differ from secular claims after all? It may turn out that since he hasn't shown the need for a transcendent God in the eschatological religions, that he hasn't given us a difference between secular claims about the world and religious claims after all. Christian claims about love, defined as there is meaning to humanity, there's a dignity to humanity, because men live after they die, could simply be statements that any secularist could make if he knew that there was consciousness after death. It wouldn't call for bringing God into the picture at all. So in all these ways, it appears that Hicks' proposal, while challenging in one sense, has not been convincing to very many philosophers. And I guess my own opinion is it's not very convincing when all is said and done either. Okay, any questions about the readings? All I've been doing is explicating your reading assignment for today up to this point. I would like to offer my own analysis of the situation and answer to the problem. Go ahead.
Do any of these guys ever confer like this? Hick ever confer with Mitchell and say, hey, how does this sound to you? Just poke some holes in it. Or do they just write it and then send it back to the publisher to Brody and figure it out?
Oh, I... No. Brody chose these pieces from published works. And there are conferences sometimes where a person will present a paper and there's a response, and there's certainly interaction in the philosophical journals between these men. But whether... these particular individuals have shared their contributions prior to publication with each other, I couldn't tell you. My guess is that they have not, but I really have no way of knowing. Yeah.
Are the tones of universalism in Hick a result of his philosophical views here, or some other presuppositions he has found?
Oh, you put me in an awkward position commenting on Hick. I find it very hard to see any uniformity or connection between most of the things Hick writes. I'm not sure the man has a unified world and life view. And besides that, he's shifted positions in the last 30 years. I mean, his recent views on the incarnation, you know, are just radical in comparison even to the neo-Orthodox views he once defended. And so I guess the answer to your question, when all said and done, is no, I don't think it is the logical outworking of what he said here. But then again, I'm not sure that anything he has said is the logical outworking of what he said elsewhere either, is my point. So, all right. Let me give you something of the background to this claim, to this challenge, to the meaningfulness of religious claims. Let me do a little philosophical background for you. The background that is of interest to us is that school of thought called logical positivism. Certain Viennese scientists and philosophers earlier in the 20th century were quite intrigued by a book written by Ludwig Wittgenstein in his earlier period, the Tractatus Philosophicus, Logical Philosophicus. The Tractatus had tried to develop a system by which the world could be adequately pictured in language. However, it turned out that the perfect language of the Tractatus, a development of Russell and Whitehead's elementary first-order logic, led to mysticism, stating that if the picture theory of reality, or the picture theory of language about reality, were true as presented in the Tractatus, then everything said in the Tractatus could not itself be meaningful. The Tractatus was its own refutation, and Wittgenstein recognized that. At the end of the Tractatus, the well-known assertion is made whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. And therewith Wittgenstein closed his philosophical books and went to the Black Forest for about 7 years, as I recall, and just left philosophy altogether. He was convinced that the Tractatus had taken him to the point of mysticism. Now, the Viennese scientists and philosophers that formulated the school of thought or constituted the school that comes to be called logical positivism were very impressed with the work of Wittgenstein and the Tractatus, and they adopted it as something of a program for them, although they tried to strip the Tractatus of its mysticism and its self-refuting character. In addition, they adopted some of the more messianic ideas and pretensions of European positivism, as you see it in Auguste Comte and others, and hence they were called logical following the Tractatus, and positivist following Comte. So you have logical positivism. And during the ascendancy of this position, or this school, Wittgenstein, as I said, had already abandoned philosophy, refusing to speak of philosophical matters. Okay, let's talk about the revisions logical positivism made. They rejected Wittgenstein's picture theory of language. They said language is not, nor ought it to be necessarily, a perfect picture of the world. And they rejected all metaphysics whatsoever, even the metaphysics that was implicit in the Tractatus. Philosophy is not concerned with discovering any facts which might be unavailable to other disciplines. That's just a way of saying philosophy has no metaphysical claims to make whatsoever. Philosophers only talk about what scientists talk about. And therefore, the task of philosophy, according to logical positivism, is simply to analyze and clarify the language of science. Okay, what kinds of language do we find then when we do an analysis of the language of science? Well, we find tautologies. Okay, a tautology is a statement like, this chair is a chair. A is A. A is not not A. Logical formulations like that. And we know that tautologies are true merely by knowing the meanings of the terms involved. If you know what a chair is, then you know that the chair is a chair must be true. Okay? Now, in addition to tautologies or logical truths, there are contradictions in our language. Okay, it is raining, but it is not raining. That would be a contradictory statement. In addition to tautologies and contradictions, the logical positivist said, we can find empirical statements. The barn is red is an empirical statement. This statement can be true, or this statement can be false. If the barn is black and you say it is red, then it's a false statement. If it happens to be red when you say it's red, then it's a true statement. These can be true or false, determined by the meaning of their terms and our investigation of the facts about the world. Only empirical statements convey any information about the world. In addition to tautologies, contradictions, and empirical statements, the logical positivist said there's one other category of language, emotive language. And this became something of a catch-all for the logical positivist, for poetry, for ethics, for religious statements, for anything they didn't think had any cognitive meaning. Okay, so you have tautologies and contradictions, empirical statements, the only ones that are really important, giving us information about the world. Then you have emotive sloth. Okay, now in addition to their categorization of language and the kinds of language we find, the logical positivist proposed what is called the verification principle of meaning. For any statement to be empirically meaningful, for any statement to be cognitively meaningful,
anything that is going to be empirically or cognitively meaningful, it must be verifiable by methods akin to those of natural science. Any statement that's going to fall into this category right here, an empirical statement, a cognitively meaningful statement, must be verifiable by the methods of natural science. Now, by that test, all ethical statements, all metaphysical statements, all religious statements, all poetic statements become cognitively meaningless. Although they may have emotive value, they may fall into the slop category down here, they do not count for the dignified status of empirically or cognitively meaningful statements, because they convey no information about the world. At best, they express an attitude toward the world. Okay, now this is the background to Flew's challenge. Now I'm going to do some criticism of the background and eventually work up to criticizing Flew's challenge. Okay, let me give you some criticisms of the verifiability principle. The first criticism would be its vagueness. One of the earliest formulations of the principle was that a statement is cognitively meaningful if it is conclusively verifiable through empirical evidence. However, that version of the principle turns out to rule out as meaningless all general statements. All general statements. Not simply all religious, metaphysical, or ethical statements, but any general statement. Let me give you an example. All bodies tend to fall to the ground. That's a perfectly general statement. It's, if you want to use the medieval phrase, it's like a universal. All bodies tend to fall to the ground, at least in our atmosphere, if you want the qualification to make it true. But you see, natural science cannot conclusively verify that, can it? Why can't natural science conclusively verify that? Why is it that science can't verify that all swans are white?
Because we haven't observed all of them.
That's right. Nobody is able to observe all swans or all falling bodies, and consequently, there can be no verification of general statements. And so it turns out that this vagueness in the verifiability principle is intolerable to natural science, because natural science relies upon certain universal statements about gravity or swans or what have you. And so in the name of exalting natural science, the verifiability principle ruins natural science. And so an alternative was suggested by Karl Popper. Please put that name in your notes. I'll expect you to know this. Karl Popper, one of the most influential philosophers of science in our age, proposed an alternative then. He said, a statement is cognitively meaningful not if it's verifiable, not using the verification principle. He says it's meaningful if it is conclusively falsifiable. If it is falsifiable, that is, if there are empirical means of showing conclusively that the statement is false, if indeed it is false, if there are empirical means by which we could falsify the statement, if it is false, then it is a meaningful statement. Now, you've got to be awake. I realize it's after lunch and maybe warm in the room and everything. He is not saying that a statement is meaningful if it's false. He's saying it's meaningful if you can specify empirical ways of falsifying it, should it be false. That is, it's subject to empirical testing and falsification. If it's subject to empirical falsification, even though it may be true and therefore never falsified, but if it's subject to falsification through empirical means, then it is a meaningful statement. Now, I hope you recognize that this is what lies behind Anthony Flew's claims about religious matters. He's not asking for verification of religion, he's asking for falsification. Is there any conclusive way through empirical channels you could falsify a religious statement? He is resting directly upon Karl Popper's reformulation of